Thank you, Barbara. Welcome, everybody. Since the talk is going to concern, to some extent, visualization of fractals, it's perhaps a good starting point is to discuss what it actually means to visualize a set. In other words, if I have a compact set, so let's say on the plane in R2, what does it actually mean to visualize it, to see a picture of it? Say if I draw a picture on the blackboard or on the computer screen, in what sense could this picture be thought to represent such a set? And how can we judge whether it's close or far? Well, I'll give you a definition. First, one preliminary definition. If I have a set like this, let me define U sub epsilon of k, the epsilon neighborhood of such a set, to be the collection of all points in the plane, well, whose distance to this set is at most epsilon. Well, let's make it open and say less than epsilon. So distance from x to my set k is less than epsilon. All right. Then the definition. Now, I know that this board sticks about half the way up, so I'm never going to raise it. All right. So here's the definition. Hausdorff distance between two compact sets, K1 and K2, which I'll just denote D sub H, K1, K2, is by definition the infimum of all positive epsilons such that K1 is contained in U epsilon of K2 and vice versa. Just maybe a quick example of what this means. So let's say this is my set K1. And this is my set K2. And visually, they are pretty close. If you stand far, far back, then perhaps the pictures will blur into one. And they're close in the Hausdorff sense, in the sense of the Hausdorff distance. I can thicken the yellow set just a little bit to capture all of the pink set on the inside. And the same thing is true for the pink set. On the other hand, if I do this, these two are not close anymore. They're not close as pictures, certainly. They're elements of the pink which are not really present in the yellow. And they're not close in the Hausdorff sense. It's still true that I only need to thicken the pink set a little bit to capture all of the yellow. But to capture all of the pink, I have to thicken the yellow set a lot, right? So this is the sense in which I'll say the two sets are close. Now, I'll talk about visualizing sets using a computer. You know, pictures of fractal sets have become rather popular. They're mostly computer generated. They can be nice, colorful, etc., etc. So what does it actually mean for the picture of a set, of a compact set like this, to be computer generated? Well, Informally, it means that I can program my computer in such a way that it can give me a good enough approximation to the true picture for any sense of good enough. So, definition, K in RQ is computable if there exists an algorithm, just a program in your favorite programming language, let's call it maybe A, which on the input N would give you, so would output, a picture. Well, it's a computer program. Output in a picture for a computer program really means coloring some pixels on the screen. Let's just assume we only have one color for simplicity, so it can either color a pixel or not, and the pixels it colors have to closely represent the set. So, the output will be a finite collection of pixels. So, for simplicity, a computer program, of course, can only output finite collections of bits. So, it's a finite collection, I goes from 1 to kn, of balls of radius ri and centers xi, where ri and xi are given by finite collections of bits. The technical term is dyadic rationals. Let's call this finite collection something, cn. And cn has to be close to to k in Hausdorff sense, and the estimate has to improve with n. So rather arbitrarily, I would ask that the Hausdorff distance from k to cn is less than 2 to the minus n. Okay? So what does this actually mean in terms of seeing a picture on a computer screen? Yes, Tom?
Are you requiring something
like
the complexity of RNA?
For the moment, nothing. So, just... for the moment, I'm not really asking any complexity-type questions. I'm not asking how hard this program has to work to actually do this thing, produce this output. I'm just asking that it stops and draws me a picture at some point. So what does it actually mean? So you can think of it in the following way. If you have a computer screen on which a pixel represents a square on the plane with side 2 to the minus n. And here is your set on the plane. Then what your program has to do in this case is output a finite collection of pixels, and it can be off by not more than the size of a pixel. It definitely has to color the pixels which get hit by the set. Like, it has to color these ones. Etc. But maybe it will be a little bit off, and it will color this one, too. It doesn't have to, but it might. It's still not such a big deal. But if it colors something here, that's wrong. That shouldn't happen. Okay? All right, so that's the definition. There is a little bit of an ambiguity in this definition because I haven't told you in which programming language this algorithm is coded, but it's turns out to be probably equivalent no matter which programming language you pick. So if you, like me, old-fashioned, think of a program in Fortran. So, all right. Now, since Tom has asked me, perhaps I can also mention that another practical question is not only whether it's possible to write such an algorithm, but also, for example, how long will this algorithm have to toil before producing such a picture? Okay, so there is a measure of that, which we can call time complexity, which is a function t of n, which bounds the amount of time the program has to think to decide whether to color or not a pixel on the screen. So, bound on deciding whether to color a pixel of size 2 to the minus n. Okay? And obviously you have to take a soup over all possible pixels, but you can look for the most efficient algorithm. All right, but this will never really enter into the discussion, at least not in any great detail. Okay, but I'm not just going to talk about drawing sets on a computer screen. I'm going to talk about drawing some very particular sets. And these sets are Julia sets of quadratic polynomial. Even if you're not consciously aware of it, you must have seen a picture of a Julia set of a quadratic polynomial. Arguably, these are the most popular mathematical pictures ever. You used to see them literally everywhere, and now, fortunately, you see them less. But you still get to see them quite a bit. So, what are these? Well, first of all, we'll look at quadratic polynomials of a very particular form. Here's the full-on thing is called the quadratic family of functions. It's the maps given by the formula f sub c of z equal to z squared plus c. Here, z is complex, so it's a point on the plane thought of as a complex number, not as just two real coordinates. And c is a parameter, which is also a complex number. An instructive exercise to all of you, well, at least those of you who have never done it, is to check that if you have a quadratic polynomial, well, I don't want to use c, so a1 w squared plus a2 w plus a3, then there is a change of coordinates on the plane z is equal to b1 w plus b2, just a linear change of coordinates, which will turn this into z squared plus c. And moreover, the c you get is unique. You cannot choose a different linear change of coordinate to get a different c. This is really a trivial exercise, but rather instructive if you've never done it. So in some sense, these polynomials are representative of all quadratic polynomials, and we are actually going to be interested in them as dynamical systems, which means that's a dynamical system, which means that you would grab a point Z naught in the plane, and you would evolve this point by applying over and over again the same map F sub C. So you're going to take this, apply F sub C, get Z1. Take this, apply F sub C, get Z2. Take this, apply F sub C, get Z3, and so on. So this way you get in a sequence, Zn is F iterated n times sub C of Z0. Such a thing is called an orbit of Z0. I'm not going to try to impress on you on how important it is to study dynamical systems. In some sense, I hope all of you don't need particular convincing that study of dynamics is important. But what is remarkable is somehow this simple formula for various values of C produces an enormous variety of behavior of orbits. All right, so let's say we actually want to study such a behavior. So we fix C, we pick our F sub C. What are the reasonable questions to ask? Well, first of all, we know the formula, Z squared plus C. That's what we're doing every time. Z1 is Z0 squared plus C, Z2 is Z1 squared plus C, etc. We don't know C, okay, but we know a lot about Z squared. If Z is large, has a large absolute value, C is not going to matter here. You're going to square it, and you're going to get a huge number. And then you're going to square it again, and C is going to be just a minor thing that you add. In other words, if absolute value of Z0 is large enough, you're guaranteed that the sequence of iterates will converge to infinity. Okay? This is trivial. All right, so it makes sense to look at what's left behind. So the first definition the filled Julia set of F sub C, which is denoted by K of F sub C, is by definition the union of all points Z0 in the plane for which this does not happen. And since for all large enough Z0 this does happen, this is the same as the set of all Z0 in the plane for which this sequence is bounded. It's obvious from the definition that this is a compact set in the plane. Nothing else really is obvious from the definition. I'm going to give you one more definition, and then I'm going to tell you some general things which are fairly easy to see about this set. The Julia set of F sub C is by definition, denoted J F sub C is by definition the boundary of K. Okay, this is also a compact set in the plane. That's obvious from the definition, and nothing else is really obvious. All right, here's one thing which I can tell you about these sets. There is one special point for this polynomial where the derivative turns to zero. That's the origin. The derivative of this is 2z. So the derivative turns to zero at the origin. The origin is called the critical point for this. And there is a rather simple dichotomy for Julia sets, or fulfilled Julia sets. Depending on whether the origin is in the Julia set, in the filled Julia set or not, so depending on whether origin is one of those bad points which go off to infinity or not, you're going to get drastically different pictures. In the following sense, so if 0 is here, then K is a connected set. Okay, the intuitive meaning is clear. It's in one piece. The formal meaning is that I cannot find two open sets in the plane such that they don't intersect, but they do intersect K, and their union is K. In other words, I cannot break it into two pieces. U1, U2 don't intersect. Oh, this thing does intersect, of course. Thank you. Okay? I cannot split it into two pieces. Yeah, thank you. Saturday, you know. And I shouldn't even be here. You shouldn't be here. But anyhow, that's a whole different story. All right. Right. So this is what I meant. Okay. And the other possibility that 0 is not in this set, well, in this case, the set is disconnected, and in fact, it's disconnected in a bad way. So this is called totally disconnected. sometimes such compact sets also called Cantor sets. And the meaning is that not only you can split it into two pieces by choosing suitable U1 and U2. In fact, you can separate any point of this set from the rest of the set by picking U1 around this point as small as you like. So you can really split off tiny little pieces of this set everywhere. So it's all in pieces, totally disconnected. Okay. This is, by the way, not particularly hard to prove. Well, it's not particularly hard to prove that the statement on top is if and only if. This is a bit trickier. Perhaps this one I leave to you as a homework exercise. What I want to do right now is I want to show an example of possibility number one for when critical point does not go off to infinity. This, by the way, the second scenario is not very interesting. In this case, the picture is not very interesting. There isn't much of a picture, in a sense. But that one can be quite interesting. All right, so here is an example when zero does not go away. So I'll not only draw a picture, I'll actually tell you for what reason zero chooses to stay around and not go off to infinity. So here is an example. Assume that there exists a point z0 in the plane whose orbit is finite. In fact, which is periodic under the iteration of our f sub c. So you start with z0 and eventually somewhere on the right here, these arrows will lead you back to z0. For simplicity, let's say that it's the third iterate of z0, which is again z0. So, what do I have? z0 is here. First arrow takes it to some point z1. This takes it to some point z2. This one takes it back. Okay? Let's make one further assumption. So such a thing is called the periodic orbit. Let's make one further assumption. Let's assume that if I compute the derivative of this thing, so if I take this and put a prime over it, that's some complex number, and if I take the absolute value of this, it's less than 1. Such a thing is called an attracting periodic orbit. The meaning of the word attraction is the following. Let's say I take a little disk around the point z0. I know the point z0 itself, after a third iterate, would return back and hit z0. What if I take a little disk around z0? What would happen? Well, it would go to a little disk here, which would go to a little disk here, not necessarily round anymore, right? Maybe a little wigglier disk. How does it come back here? Well, if you like by the intermediate value theorem, or if you like simply because a map on a small scale looks like its derivative multiplied by z, the image of this disk is going to be smaller. The derivative here has absolute value less than 1. Since on a small scale, your map is more or less linear, if this thing had some radius r, then the third iterate of it would have radius r times this derivative, less than r. So the picture would look like this. And the image of that, under a third order, it is going to be even smaller, and then even smaller, and so on. In other words, the orbit of any point which starts near Z0 will converge to this particular cycle. And that's why the cycle is attracting. Okay, if you want to see the opposite effect, just reverse the inequality here. And then you would see just the opposite. Okay, so what does it have to do with the general picture? Well, I know that these orbits, the ones which are in yellow here, they are not going to go off to infinity. They have a rather different future. They are going to converge to this period 3 cycle. Okay, so they are, by definition, in my set capital K. So it turns out the classical theorem of Fatou, classical, I mean 1920s, that in this case the orbit of 0 converges to the cycle. So 0 itself is in yellow, 0 is in capital K by definition, and by the first statement over there, capital K is a connected set. What will it look like? I'll tell you exactly what it will look like. To see how big the yellow set is, let's start now go in reverse. Instead of taking forward images, which make this disk only smaller, let's take backward images, pre-images. They should make this disk larger. Well, if I take this disk and I take its pre-image around point Z2, it's going to be some slightly larger disk. And if I'm going to take the pre-image of that around the point Z1, it's going to be a slightly larger disk and a slightly larger disk here. Remember, they're not round. They're a little wiggly. So I shouldn't be really saying disks, but you'll forgive me. Okay, so what happens is that as you keep doing this, you are going to catch the critical point 0 in one of these. Maybe here. At this point, what will the next preimage look like? Well, you have to remember that our map is Z squared plus C. So there is a symmetry built in here. I can replace Z with minus Z and get the same image. So the next preimage is going to look somehow like this. And then if I keep taking the preimages, this is the picture that I'm going to see. I'm going to see some maximal disk around here. I'm going to see some maximal disk around here. And I'm going to see some maximal disk around here. They're actually going to touch at one point here. That's not all. Remember, there is a symmetry. So these two ears here, these three are interchanged, right? This one goes to this one goes to this one goes to this one. But there are two symmetric ones here, which when this thing is folded over, are mapped to these two. Well, but then, for example, this thing has two ears which are mapped to these two. And this thing has two ears which are mapped to these two ears. And then it's easy to see that there should be two ears here and two ears here and correspondingly ears here and here and two ears on each of these ones and here and so on. So there will be infinitely many ears drawing of this thing. And then I have to draw them all and then I have to take their closure and that will give me the capital K. Okay? And in fact, the set in orange, that is, if I ignore the yellow and only look at the orange, is capital J, the Julia set. This Julia set actually has a name. It's called the rabbit. You know, because of the ears. All right. So I did draw a picture of a fractal for you. Okay, so how can one actually produce a set like this algorithmically? How can one draw a set like this on a computer screen rather than me drawing this on the board? In a sense, how can you verify that the picture actually does look like this? I mean, I gave you some reasons when I was drawing it. But perhaps I was cheating a bit. Probably I was. And this is probably not exactly what the rabbit looks like. Right? Maybe this is not wiggly enough. Maybe this ear has to be a little bit like this. So how can the program a computer to draw a picture like this? Okay, the most naive thing is the following. All right, I want to draw the pictures which don't go off to infinity. I know that if that knot is large enough, then the orbit is guaranteed to go off to infinity. So let's say I pick some value of C. Let's say it's less than 10. And then I'm guaranteed that if absolute value of Z naught is bigger than 10, then the orbit of Z naught is going to go to infinity. Right? The absolute value of the first digit is going to be at least 90. So this thing is going to go to infinity and very fast. This is very crude. You can produce one estimate for all C's, but never mind. So what I can do, here is a very naive algorithm. Or maybe I shouldn't call it naive. I'll call it the escape time algorithm. Fix some large n. Take a pixel, for which you want to decide whether to color it or not. Let Z naught be its center. And consider the following algorithm. Set n equal to, I'm sorry, set z equal to z naught, set z1 equal to fc of z, ask, is absolute value of z1 bigger than 10? Oh, maybe we should have this here. And I also need a counter. K is equal to 1, and is k less than capital N. Okay. Not doing this very well, am I? Here's what I should really do. I haven't written an actual computer program in quite a while, and that shows. My apologies. What I really want to do is I want to grab the damn point, I want to iterate it n times, and I want to check every time, is the absolute value bigger than 10 or not? If it's bigger than 10, fit, exit. This point is not in the field Julia said that's guaranteed. Well, if it's not, keep on iterating. If you can go n times without ever going outside of radius 10, you win. This point, we say, is in our set. So, how do I formalize it? Is k less than n? So, if no, we exit. If yes, we go on. We set z1 equal to fc of z0. Can we ask, is absolute value of that one bigger than 10? Okay, if yes, we exit. And if no, then we increment k. We switched, we say that the new z is that one, and we go back. In this case, we exit and color z0, and in this case, we exit and do not color z0. We're guaranteed to exit. We exit here, then our point is in, and if we exit here, then our point is out. Okay, to begin with, this is very arbitrary. How do you set n? Well, you pick some reasonable value, which would allow you to actually see the end result and still have time for lunch. And once you've done that, you run the risk that there are points which do escape to infinity, but do this very, very slowly. What typically happens is that these are points which are hidden sort of in the narrow valleys of this picture. So these points you won't see very well when you apply an algorithm like this. This is not going to work very well. There is an improvement of this. Which is called the distance estimator algorithm, and this is due to Milner. And the idea is the following. So here is your picture. Here is your z-naught. In the previous scenario, I was iterating z-naught to see if there is going to be a moment of time that the orbit exits a disk of radius 10. Now, with this modification, I'm going to do the same thing, only I'm also going to keep track of the derivative of the iterator. So when I arrive here, I know not only zk, but I also know the derivative of the kth iterator. And what is this derivative telling me? The derivative is basically telling me by what multiple I have to increase a tiny little disk around this point if I run it by the sequence of iterators. I mean, how big is it going to be here? If these were actually round disks, if the map was actually linear, if this were actually round disks, and I know that the derivative increases by this much, and I give you a crude estimate that the Julius had maybe half way in this picture, then from here I could actually tell more or less how far this point is from the Julia set. Right? I could just take this disk, which is guaranteed to be out, take its pre-image, which is guaranteed to be out, that's the distance. And more or less, this idea can be made to work. This is more precise, but again, there's this question of how do you pick n? All right, so let me tell you that for the rabbit, one can actually answer this. There is a fact. For this picture, there exists a neighborhood of the Julia set and a smooth change of coordinates, phi, on this neighborhood. So this is a change of coordinates. Such that in the new coordinates, my map has derivative which is strictly bigger than 1. Let's call this estimate something. So it's strictly bigger on a compact set, so there is some lower bound which is bigger than 1. Let's say call it lambda. What this means is the following. So let's say this is my neighborhood U. I can change coordinates here in such a way that the derivative of my map is bigger than 1. What does this mean? This means that if the distance from my point to the Julia set is not 0, then every time I iterate, it will be multiplied by at least lambda. Okay? So here, actually, in this case, it's not difficult to say how many iterates you have to take to get a picture with given precision. Your distances to this picture are roughly expanded by lambda every time. So there is no problem. If you want to know whether to color a pixel of size 2 to the minus n, you just have to multiply it by lambda enough times so that the size will become about 10. All right, so what about fractals that you can never see? See that I spend too much time telling you about Julia sets, and I haven't told you enough about computing them. So I want to answer the question of whether quadratic Julia sets are computable in the sense that I mentioned in the beginning. So are Julia sets computable? So that means I have my J sub C. I would like to have an algorithm A, which on input n outputs a set Cn, which is a finite collection of pixels, such that this is a good enough picture of J up to the size of 1 pixel. There is one extra complication here. These sets depend on a parameter, C. C is a complex number. Drawing such a set might involve having to iterate C, for example. So I have to somehow let my program know the value of C. So let's actually give it to the program. So let's put an instruction in here, input C, or read C. Yeah, I cannot possibly make my program read the whole decimal extension of C, which might a priori be infinite. But I can let it know as many digits of C as it wants. Okay? So this is a slightly modified definition. So now I'm asking whether there exists a program which is allowed to ask me for the value of C. I'll just type it in from the keyboard. Such that an N will do this. Okay? And this is what one does in practice. And we're really trying to answer a practical question here. So, question, given C, does there exist an algorithm which can read C, which on N does this? And the answer is no. This is the theorem of Mark Braverman, who is a graduate student here, is present right now, and myself, that there exists C for which no such algorithm exists. So, what do their pictures look like? You might actually want to know, even though I told you that you cannot produce them with the help of a computer, and I can show you one picture of a set like this. Thank you. Something like this will work. It's a fairly well-known picture. This is a picture on a one-pixel screen. The pixel intersects the set, so according to our definition of computability, we have to color it all. Okay, now what happens? I'm only partly joking. What happens if your screen has, oh, I don't know, 50 pixels? So it's a 50 by 50 pixel square. Well, the theorem tells you that among all possible pictures that you can have on this screen, there is no systematic way to select the correct one. Not for this value of C. You cannot select such a picture in a systematic way. How many pictures can you draw? Let's say we have only two colors, black and white. How many pictures can you draw? 50 by 50 and two colors for each little square, so it's 2 to the power 50 squared. And the best you can do to visualize this set is to take a picture at random and hope that it's the right one. Because there is really no systematic way to select it. So this is not much better than the best thing you can do to visualize it. Now, perhaps, since I still have 3 minutes and there are some experts in the audience, I can tell you a little bit about how such a thing can be proved. So the proof itself is rather involved, but here is a little idea to which can give you a starting point. Here is a little proposition. Not all JC can be drawn by one algorithm. Okay? Much weaker. I mean, there are ones which cannot be drawn by any algorithm, so this obviously should be true, but let's deal with the situation that not all can be drawn with one algorithm. There's an easy explanation. Let's say that a set S is a set of C's such that J sub C are drawn by one algorithm. Then J sub C is continuous on S as a function from C, which is in the complex plane, to J sub C, where I'm looking at compact sets with the Hausdorff metric. Why? Well, my reader of C, this input line, can ask for only finitely many digits of C. So if there is a jump in the picture, at some value of C, if there is a discontinuous change, there is not a chance that my algorithm will produce the correct result. At some point, it has to make up its mind. This or that, and it can only see finitely many digits. So it will have to make a mistake. So to prove this, I just need to show one example of discontinuous behavior of Julia sets on the parameters, and that's very easy. So like I said, this bit is for the experts. Let's say my F sub C has a Siegel disk. That is, it has a fixed point, for example, such that the derivative is e to the 2 pi I theta, with theta irrational. And near this fixed point, I can change coordinates conformally in such a way that the map will become linear. Okay? So, locally, around this point, my map is just a rotation. Such a thing is called a Siegel point, and the maximal neighborhood in which the map is a rotation is called the Siegel disk. And here is an example of a Julia set with a Siegel disk. This is the fixed point. This is the Siegel disk. This is the critical point. It's in the middle of the picture. And everything else you see here are pre-images of the Siegel disk. Okay, what happens if you change your C just slightly to turn theta into a rational number, so to violate this condition? You can do this by changing C just a little bit. This picture immediately implodes. What happens is that now the center of the Siegel disk becomes a point in the Julia set. So the Julia set will now pierce this boundary of the Siegel disk here and go all the way to the center. And like in that picture with the smiley face inside of a circle, the bottom picture is far from the top picture, very far. And it's an arbitrarily small change. So if my set contains both a theta like this and the sequence of rationals converging to theta, there is no hope that one machine, one algorithm, can deal with this set. Okay? So at least they cannot all be drawn by one algorithm. Any algorithm you can take. Those two which I outlined to you or any other thing cannot draw them all. But then, of course, there are ones for which there is no algorithm whatsoever. Okay. Thank you for your attention.